fifth kind. This video is in association with Gaia.com, creating thought-provoking documentaries and programs. For unlimited access to thousands of educational works and documentaries, please click the links in the description now and receive your 1 month exclusive full access price for only 99 cents. Throughout our ancient past, humankind has documented various connections with advanced beings. These stories can be found engraved upon the walls of temples and inscribed in religious works all over the world. When the ancients asked from where they came, the visitors pointed toward the stars. It is now a popular belief that the star system referred to was Sirius. Yet wherever they came from, we believe it to be a world similar to our Earth. With the right atmospheric conditions and gravitational forces needed to visit the Earth and survive upon it. Just as we explore space today, looking for a planet with similar conditions to our own, it makes sense to assume that other intelligent life throughout the universe would behave in a similar way. Author and researcher Eric von Daniken explains.
Whatever they came from, their home planet cannot have been completely different to us. It must be a planet similar to Earth, otherwise they could not have survived here on this planet. So the question, where did they come from? We cannot answer, but it must have been an Earth-like planet. Now, our astronomers today find daily, practically, more planetary systems. So we have to look which ones are the closest to us. Probably they came from there.
If the gods are indeed galactic travelers from a faraway planet, with advanced exploration technology, to know their intentions, we can again ask ourselves, what would humankind do in the same situation? Within our known history, many shameful acts have been committed against fellow humans, wrongly justified simply by the group or individual's notion of superiority above others. This is a repeating problem, and we still see it today. But perhaps, if we do reach the technological capabilities needed to enable our own interstellar travel agency, we would in turn have progressed further on a consciousness level, breaking down barriers of indifference and cultural separation. In which case, we may be more understanding and caring toward a different species, helping it along a prosperous path, teaching of our own struggles, lessons, and mistakes. Author Richard Dolan has researched the various possibilities for many years.
Let's say we were an alien group and we were here on Earth. We don't look like the natives, but we have an interest in their civilization. We have an interest in monitoring. Maybe we even have an interest in managing them because we realize that they're shooting like this in terms of their technology, and they're about to leap into our world, whether we like it or not. So we might want to establish a presence and influence among them. We might want to have a base on their world for some reason. If we did, how would we do that? Well, we would have to have our own people who look just like them, our own fifth column. Is this really the case? I don't know that it's the case. I think you'd be foolish not to consider it as a reasonable thing.
As covered in some of our other videos, we find documented accounts within many ancient civilizations referencing beings from the stars, such as the Epic of Gilgamesh, where we learn of the Anunnaki, the Egyptian mythology of deities and sky gods, the Indian gods who came to Earth in flying machines known as Vimanas.
Now in the Hindu mythology, there they describe twins. The name of the twins were the Maruts. And they clearly say that the Maruts were flying between the continents. They were flying between India and Central America. So both continents were influenced by the same gods. That's why we have the same type of pyramids, step pyramids like towers, not comparable to Egypt, because the Maruts, the twin of Maruts, were flying. The Maruts were flying with Vimanas, and the flying machines of the Maruts were described again in the Drona Parva. They described that the machines, the flying machines of the Maruts, made a terrible noise. But the Maruts, the twins, they could fly all over the planet, wherever they want, without the landing, without the refuel. So their energy must have been something which we cannot understand. By the way, energy of the Vimanas, in some of the texts, the energy is described, the fuel, what they use as energy, but we are not able to translate everything. I know Professor Dr. Dinlep Kanjilal. He's one who can read the Sanskrit text. And he told me, we found writings about the fuel, the composition of the fuel. And there are some words which we understand. For example, part of it was quicksilver. We can translate the word quicksilver. Part of it was mica. We know what mica is, okay? But other components of the fuel, we cannot translate. Some of them sound like honey. Honey, what kind of honey? There are different kinds. Something sweet, something, you know, we have no translation. If we would have the translations of all the components of these Vimana fuels, then we probably would have a new energy for our machines here. Many of our so-called myths have dates. Dates about the humans and the kings. And these dates are, for us humans, impossible. I was talking about Palenque. And Palenque, there's tombstone under the temple, the pyramid of inscription. Palenque, there is Pakal, the second ruler of Palenque. In the grave, there are datings which you can read. And one of the datings gives a figure of 1,200,000 years before Pakal. How is this possible? Or in ancient Sumeria, we had the so-called King's List. The King's List, which today is in the British Museum in London. And there they give the names of all the Sumerian kings before the Great Flood. It comes together more than 200,000 years. And then the flood comes, and after the flood, the gods descended again from the sky, and the gods who ruled after the sky, still together, they ruled 24,000 years and 301 years and a few months. We have exact dates. Now in India again, in the Indian mythology, we find impossible dates. All these dates are confusing. You have a possibility, but it's really speculation. We all know when you are in a spaceship which travels in a very, very high speed, the time between the spaceship and the planet is different. So an astronaut who would fly, let's say, to the next solar system, to Proxima Centauri, with a very high speed, would maybe become only a few years later, older, while on the planet Earth, 2,000 or 3,000 years might have passed. So it might be that these so-called gods in the universe, they were traveling with high speed. And on Earth, in fact, hundreds and thousands of years passed. But we are still talking about the same gods. But that's not the final answer. That's one of the possibilities. When I speak to Western scientists, for example, Germans or Swiss Indologists, they say, we are talking about the stories in the Veda. They say, well, it's maybe about 500 BC, not older. When I ask the same questions to Hindu professors, which know much more than our Western scientists, they are saying at least 6,000 years in the past. It's much older than what we thought. First, the extraterrestrials, finally, they went back home. Some of the mother spaceships were destroyed. At least two of them we know from Arjuna, they were destroyed. One of the other mother spaceships simply disappeared because the gods, the so-called gods, maybe helped themselves like today ethnologists would do. They study some group, they teach some group, they give some advice, and finally they disappear again. They don't want to die here on this planet. They run away. And the Vimanas, they take them with this. Of course, when we today, we have ethnologists with high technology. Our ethnologists, for example, they have a photo apparat, you know, or they have, maybe they have a light in their hand. They have technology, maybe they have a rifle, whatever, a weapon. So all these precise instruments, photos, light, etc., our ethnologists take back with them again. They don't leave it there. The same thing happened in the past. Their technology disappeared because they took them back with them. There is the almighty god Shiva. And Shiva had a flying machine, a flying bird. This flying bird was Garuda. And Garuda was flying around Shiva. Now Garuda was not the normal bird because Garuda even flew to the moon. Garuda was able to fly away from our solar system. Garuda also used bombs. Garuda were bringing his master Shiva to different places in our solar system, not only on Earth. So Garuda was a kind of spaceship, space vehicle, etc.
That is 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. We have to go ready to start. 2, 1, 0. Booster ignition and liftoff of Shuttle Endeavour, NASA's final space station crew compartment that brings a bay window view to our celestial backyard.
The most interesting fact, which really shocks your head, is the tombstone of Palenque. I was standing on this tombstone, I made photos, and you're completely shocked. The picture is absolutely clear. There is a man sitting in a sort of capsule, bending forward like a motor racing cyclist. He uses his hand to manipulate. He has a mask on his nose. He's sitting on a chair, and outside the frame, there is a linking flame. When you see all this, you're completely shocked. And you know, this stone plate was chiseled at least 2,600 years ago in the past. So this was the real revelation in archaeological view. The Temple of Inscription in Palenque, which is in reality a pyramid, according to official archaeology, is maybe about 600 AD, so not very old. But the tomb with the tombstone of Palenque, because there were stalactites and stalagmites, must be much older than the pyramid, which was built up later on the tomb. So at least 2,500 years, if not much more.
In the Old Testament, within the book of Ezekiel, written in the first person, Ezekiel describes an encounter with beings in a flying machine. The passage reads, "I looked and I saw a windstorm coming out of the north, an immense cloud with flashing lightning and surrounded by brilliant light. The center of the fire looked like glowing metal, and in the fire was what looked like four living creatures. In appearance, their form was human, but each of them had four faces and four wings. Spread out above the heads of living creatures was what looked like something like a vault, sparkling like crystal and awesome. Under the vault, their wings were stretched out, one toward the other, and each had two wings covering its body. When the creatures moved, I heard the sound of their wings, like the roar of rushing waters, like the voice of the Almighty."
Ezekiel writes, "Out of a sudden they hear the noise in the sky. All the slaves look up there. Then he sees an object coming down from the sky. Then he realizes that the object makes a tremendous noise. He compares the noise with the thundering of a waterfall. Or he compares it with fighting wagons. So a terrible noise this object made. All the slaves looking there, the object comes down, sand is blown up. Ezekiel is high priest by profession, so he believes in the beginning it must be God. He falls on his nose to pray to the Lord. And then he realizes this is not God. And then he describes exactly what he sees. He describes not only the noise, he describes the wings. The wings move. When the wings moved, that the tremendous noise started to be there again. When the wings stood still, they were hanging down. He describes the leg. He clearly says the leg were out of metal. Then he cries the wheel, and the wheel shocked him totally, because wheel of his times can go forward and backward. But the wheel which he sees here They go also forward and backward, but at the same time, left and right, without making a steering movement. You see, when you are sitting in your car today and you want to make a curve, you make on your wheel a curve, a steering movement, and the wheels are turning now that you come in your curve. Ezekiel sees a wheel which goes forward, backward, right and left without making a steering movement. This shocks him so he cannot understand it. He describes it four times.
Erich von Däniken is well-versed and educated in biblical scripture. He believes that the gods described within the Book of Enoch were an advanced race of beings who sinned against humankind, giving a unique perspective and using a vocabulary we can relate to within our current time of modern technology.
Imagine a normal ship on the ocean 200 years ago. So they are maybe for weeks on the ship, on board the ship. Now they came to an island with beautiful girls. What do? They have sex. The same thing happened with the extraterrestrials. They were for maybe hundreds of years in their spaceships. They were working in their spaceship, the astronauts. Now they came to the planet Earth. And as the Bible says, they saw that the daughters of men were beauty. So they took them to wife. By the way, in sort of the Bible translation, they say, the fallen angels saw that the daughters of men were beauty, and they took them to wife. What is a fallen angel? They who descended. And not only in the Bible, you find this absolutely clear again in the Book of Enoch. They clearly say the guardians of the sky, they had a mutiny on board. Some of them wanted to have sex with beautiful humans. They wanted to have contact, sexual contact with them. But it was forbidden to do so. That's written in the Book of Enoch. So they make a mutiny. Enoch gives even the names of 36 of these extraterrestrial figures, which say, we want to go down there, we want to have sex, we want to do this, even if it's against what the Lord is the commander of the spaceship, says. And they had sex, and the result was some different creatures and giants and all these things.
One of the most notorious earthly mysteries within the Bible is the Ark of the Covenant, a device described as having great powers, emitting an energy source, resulting in the poisoning of those in its vicinity, ultimately leading to death. A similar description to that of radiation poisoning, in correlation to modern nuclear reactor technology. Could the Ark be a nuclear device within the ancient past?
The Ark of the Covenant was an absolute dangerous object. And the Ark of the Covenant definitely had radioactivity. In the second book of the Kings, the Ark of the Covenant is transported. And one of the priests, his name is Ussa, he simply, because there was a moment where the Ark looked as if she would fall from the wagon. One of the priests, his name was Ussa, he touched the Ark. And at the same second, he died, like from an electricity power. And in the book of Samuel, it says, everyone who came too close to the Ark of the Covenant died. And they describe how they died, that their skin became pale, their nails on fingers and feet fell out, they were blind, etc. So they were afraid of the Ark of the Covenant, and freely, by free will, they brought it back to Israel. The Israelites the next morning saw that the Ark of the Covenant were here again, with four horses. The horses were already near dead. The children of Israel were dancing around the Ark of the Covenant, praying to the Lord that the Ark of the Covenant is back finally from the land of the enemy. And at that morning, so says the Bible, 72 of the Israelites died, including children. What have these children done wrong? The only thing, they were too close to the Ark of the Covenant, because the Ark of the Covenant was absolutely dangerous. You know, Aaron was the priest, the brother of Moses. And Aaron was the one who created a new priesthood. Only those ones are allowed to go close to the Ark of the Covenant. They had to wear separate suits, seven times woven, separate clothes, The Ark of the Covenant was dangerous because it was in reality a plutonium reactor. Plutonium reactors are used today in our satellites. If you need a satellite who needs power for 20 or 40 years, you need a miniature plutonium reactor. Plutonium reactors are never used on Earth because they are incredibly dangerous. Plutonium is really dangerous. A powder of plutonium can kill thousands of people. It's a very, very high radioactivity. That's why we use it only in satellites, and they never tell it to the humans. But in these satellites, the energy came from plutonium reactors. So, finally, the Ark of the Covenant was back with the Israelites. 72 of them died. They continued their trip, and Solomon created the first temple. Solomon put the Ark of the Covenant in a temple, in a holy place. Then Solomon, by the way, he had some flying machines. Solomon could fly all the time. This flying machines of Solomon is not part of the Bible. It's part of the so-called Kebra Negest. The Kebra Negest is the book of the kings of Ethiopia. There you read about the flying machines of King Solomon. They even say how fast it was. So in one day, he made the distance of 30 days if you would go on the ground. Anyhow, Solomon created a temple and had a separate room for the Ark of the Covenant. Now Solomon, because he can fly, he had a girlfriend, the Queen of Sheba, in today's Ethiopia. He visited her different times, and they had a boy together. He went to visit his father Solomon. So he comes from 2 days Ethiopia with the caravan, with many camels, and came to Jerusalem. And in Jerusalem, Ben Alechem said to his father Solomon, "My mother, the Queen of Sheba, which you love so sincere, has some problems for enemy. And she asked me to come to Jerusalem that I should bring the Ark of the Covenant to Ethiopia, to the Queen of Sheba, because the people who have the Ark of the Covenant, they always have power," she said. Now Solomon said to his son, "This is impossible. My own people, my priests, would kill me if I would allow you to take the Ark of the Covenant out of the Temple of Jerusalem." But the boy was finally the son of Solomon. He was a priest himself. So at night, he went with a few followers into the temple, into the room where the Ark of the Covenant was standing. He made an exact copy of it. They went out again. And outside the walls of Jerusalem, his artists created a copy of the Ark of the Covenant. At night, they made the priest of Solomon drunken. They went into the temple. They stole the original Ark of the Covenant, and they put the copy there. The next morning, the priest didn't even realize it. It took 2 or 3 days before they realized that not the original is anymore in the Temple of Jerusalem. It is a copy. Now Solomon, he knew exactly it was my son. And he went with his horses to follow, but he could never reach him because Ben Alechem, with the Ark of the Covenant, again was flying in one of these flying machines to today's Ethiopia. So the original of the Ark of the Covenant arrived, in fact, at today's Ethiopia. The Queen of Sheba, she was very, very happy. Thousands of people surrounded the Ark of the Covenant, and thousands of people died. Again, with the same sickness as we had before in the second book of the Kings. Now, the Queen of Sheba was afraid of the Ark of the Covenant. She realized that this object is dangerous. She put it down in a hole in the ground. And exactly there, today, in the Ethiopian city of Aksum, the cathedral of the Holy Virgin Mary is standing. Now, this is Coptical Christianity in Ethiopia. And a few years ago, the head of the Coptical Church was in Switzerland shortly and in Germany. And one journalist asked him, "Do you know about the Ark of the Covenant? Is it true that this is in Ethiopia under the Church of the Holy Virgin Mary?" And the chief said, "Yes, I was one of them who saw the Ark of the Covenant. This object is not from this planet. This object is from another planet." So sometimes I'm asked by the critics, where are the proofs for extraterrestrials? The Ark of the Covenant, even if only a piece of it, has survived would be a final proof. But that's a question of religion. Religions would never allow us to go down there and to make scientific researches on this object. So the time is not ripe for it. We have to change again the spirit of time.
Although the Ark of the Covenant has yet to be found, we have discovered other such mysterious items that go against modern historical teaching of our ancient ancestors' technical progress, such as the Antikythera mechanism, a 2,000-year-old ancient mechanism found off the coast of Greece, and the Zhanghong seismoscope, a device that was able to detect seismic activity, such as earthquakes, dating back to around 100 AD. With decades of documented evidence and mysterious artifacts now discovered throughout the world, it would be a logical conclusion to assume we have indeed been visited and guided by an advanced civilization within our ancient past.
We will recognize the extraterrestrials because they are similar to us. They are, of course, wiser to us. Their technological standard is much more advanced than ours. Because if they would not be much more advanced, they could never have reached us. You know, the distance between the stars are measured in light years. So if you don't have the technology, you cannot reach it. Even if they have developed something like overspeed of light. In our society, we say, according to Einstein, overspeed of light is not possible. But with the big distances, there must be a way for overspeed of light. They know it. They know the way how to do it. So they are much more advanced than we. We will recognize them. At the same time, they are wise. You know, these extraterrestrials who have technology to reach out distances of light years, they are not stupid again. These are not animal-like beings who just reach the distances to kill others. It makes no sense. They are wise. They are soft. They are helpful. They are understanding to us and not just animals who are there to kill us, like we have it in some science fiction pictures. Professor Dr. John Mack was a professor at Harvard University. He has studied extraterrestrial abductions. I knew him. We have been together just between us for quite some time. And I asked him, how many extraterrestrials do exist out there? And he said, there are hundreds of thousands of different forms of extraterrestrials out there. Some of them are humans, and we probably only get in contact with the more or less human form of extraterrestrials. But there are hundreds of thousands of different forms of there. We just don't know it. A universe, as vast as our universe is, must have many, many forms of intelligent life. If not, you cannot contact them. You have no possibility to talk to them, to learn from them. So you have to multiply intelligence in the universe.
Just as we send probes to Mars and throughout our solar system, searching for a planet with the right conditions to sustain life, and given the analysis based on the Kepler space mission data, listing as many as 40 billion Earth-sized planets orbiting in the habitable zones that we know of within our galaxy, it would be highly unlikely, maybe even statistically impossible, that we are alone in the universe. There have been many reported encounters of strange objects in the sky, with many declassified government documents being released into the public domain, including odd news statements from highly ranked government officials, such as former Pentagon official Luis Elizondo and Paul Hellyer, the former Canadian defense minister. Talk show host George Nooney and Richard Dolan, who have personal contact with the ex-defense minister, expand on his recent TV broadcast.
The former Minister of Defense of Canada, Paul Hellyer, has told me specifically that he believes in an extraterrestrial presence.
Do aliens exist? Are they already here? Do they pose a threat or a chance for salvation?
Honorable Paul Hellyer, former Minister of Defense of Canada, and he believes that life forms from space exist and are present on Earth. It's great to have you with us on our show. Why do you say that UFOs are as real as the airplanes flying over our heads?
Well, because I know that they are. They've been, as a matter of fact, they've been visiting our planet for thousands of years. And one of the cases that would interest you most, if you give me 2 or 3 minutes to answer, is during the Cold War, 1961, there were about 50 UFOs in formation flying south from Russia to the across Europe. And the Supreme Allied Commander was very concerned and about ready to press the panic button when they turned around and went back over the North Pole.
I love how Paul said, give me 2 or 4 minutes to talk about this specifically.
Right.
He is into this, and he's into it in a big way.
That's right.
And he's either a liar or this guy is really telling the truth. There's no middle ground here.
Well, he's certainly not a liar. I also know Paul, and he's got a great deal of integrity. And he's, you know, done a lot of research into this subject, as well as many, many other people have done. And I think it's very important that we have someone of his stature who's willing to go out there. And by the way, that was a very good interview he gave with Sophie Shevardnadze. We need, you know, to get more prominent individuals.
He may be the highest level of government official that has gone public like this.
He is. There was actually a minister of defense of France back in the 70s, a man named Robert Gallet, who gave an interview, not nearly as prominently, though, as Paul Hellyer.
Yeah.
As we continue to explore the planets within our solar system, our forever developing modern technology is able to take high definition photographs from the surface of Mars using satellites and the Curiosity rovers. On examination of the images, we can clearly see strange anomalies and shapes with elements of intelligent design upon the surface.
Our space probes today are on Mars. They surround Mars. A small robot with the name of Curiosity is rolling over Mars. And again, we receive pictures from the surface of the Mars. And some of these pictures clearly show structures which are not normal. Again, we look for the next plausible answer. And sooner or later, we have no more plausible answer. We have religions, and we are educated in our religions. And now we learn that most of these things are wrong. So we lose our ground. We lose our reason of life. We say we have been living here and praying, and we went to church, and we were adoring some gods and making designs and technology in the name of them. And now we realize it was not spiritual, it was all extraterrestrials. They are technologically ahead of us. They simply visit us. We are the primitives in their eyes. So we will lose a lot. And a contact between extraterrestrials and us in the beginning would be a shock. That's why, by the way, they do it in a soft way, with crop circles, etc. They had the technology to do it in a hard way, but they do it in a soft way, and because they understand how we react. So it's reasonable, even from the scientific community, and sometimes even for the government, to go forward in a slow way with that information, not just shock mankind. By the way, this is one of the reasons why I do my job. I have many speeches worldwide, and my lectures are quite impressive. You see wonderful things. And at the end of every speech, I say to the audience, dear ladies and gentlemen, this is not a question of believe it or not. I would turn myself in my tomb if some idiots come up and make a sort of religion or sect of Eric von Däniken's knowledge. So why am I doing what I'm doing? Because I want that mankind see all this information from the past, from another angle, which brings us another answer and another spirit of the world. That's my duty. I want to change the spirit of time. Some of our scientists, I guess some of the astronomers, some of the genetics, they know already what is going on. But they do not go to public because their own colleagues say, please don't. You make us ridiculous. You make our scientific society ridiculous because the people will not believe it to you. We have to do it softly, step by step, not just like a shock. And I think this is the feeling of the ETs too. Do it softly, not shock the humans. I met in my life different people from the scientific community or from the military community who showed me and expressed me something which I should not go to public. But I know it. I have seen it. This is why I am so sure, so self-sure that I'm sitting on the right horse. I know much more than what I publish because some things should not be published. 100 years ago, in Fatima is a little village in Portugal. There, 70,000 people saw a UFO. Now, at that time, the church could not say it's a UFO. They called it was a wonder, a miracle of the sun. When you go today to Fatima in a gigantic cathedral, the cathedral dedicated to the Holy Mother Virgin Mary, you see in glass painting the miracle of the sun and thousands of people watching the sky. Now, 100 years ago, that took place. It started all on May 13th, and it repeated for 6 months, and it ended on October 13th. Now, one of the girls, her name was Lucia, she received a message, and the message she should give to the highest commander on this planet, not to the King of Portugal. The message went to the Holy Pope in Rome. It was Benedict XV. So the child, Lucia, later went into a convent. She became a nun. And she gave the message to the Pope with the order to publish this message to mankind on October 13th, 1960, 43 years after 1917. The Pope, 1960, read the message. Many journalists were around it, and the newspapers of 1960 said, the Pope answered, I cannot publish this message. It would create a panic among humans. Now, my God, if the message would come from the real Mother Virgin Mary, she knows what she does. And the Pope say, I cannot publish it. It would create a panic. Because of this answer, journalists start a bit speculation. They said, maybe the message has to do with the next world war, with the third world war. We will all be destroyed, etc. So they went, journalists, went to the Bishop of Leira. Leira is the next biggest city to the village of Fatima. And the bishop was living in Leira. And they asked the bishop, does this message from Fatima has something to do with the next world war? With, you know, rockets, Pershing, SS-20 and so on. And the bishop, who knew the message, says, no, it has absolutely nothing to do with the next world war, with the destruction of mankind. It concerns our belief. Now, when it concerns our belief, why should they not publish it? Mother Mary was the one who gave order to publish it, and the Catholic Church doesn't publish it. In my opinion, it was a message from extraterrestrials. The extraterrestrials in 1917, they surrounded our planet. They realized in 1970, mankind had no technology, advanced technology, for a message going around the world. There were no satellites in 1970. There were no television in 1970, etc. So they simply calculated, give them another 40 years, and then they will be ready. In this message, probably, and now I have to speculate, probably he said, well, welcome humans, greetings to you humans. Don't be afraid of us. You are not alone in the universe. There are many other societies in the universe. We were here thousands of years ago. We will visit you again, etc. We will come back in the next decades and so on. Now, between 1917 and 1960, 43 years have passed, and Fatima has become a pilgrim place. Gigantic cathedral is in Fatima. Millions of believers pray to the Holy Virgin Mary. And now in 1960, the Pope realized in this message, it was not the Holy Virgin Mary. That's why he said, I cannot publish it. It would create a panic. Now speculations come up, has it to do with the next World War? And the Bishop of Leyla said, no, it has nothing to do with the next World War. It concerns our belief. Yes, because it was the extraterrestrials and not the Mother Mary. Now 100 years have passed. This year, I expect maybe that they show up again. They show us again what in 1970 they believed it's a miracle of the sun. But it was not the miracle of the sun. It was an extraterrestrial spaceship. They gave us 100 years of time, and they will show up again. I hope, at least, this is my wish, my dream. All the popes since 1960 know the message. None of them has opened it to the public, none of them. There are speculations, all kinds of speculations. I studied this very carefully. The speculations contradict each other. Some of the popes are really telling lies concerning Fatima. I was one of these figures which already 30 years ago was in Colorado in the mountain called Space Command. I was one of there. At that time, it was a secret visit. And I saw they observe everything around the Earth, everything. They said, you see, this is exactly the Soyuz satellite, whatever numbers it, and said, well, this is calculated. They said, no. It's exactly now over America, we can, and every position there. Of course, I asked them about UFOs. Have you ever, with your observation, see UFOs? They said, of course. I said, what do you say to it? Said, we can say nothing. They are too fast. Their speed is so incredible. And they make some maneuvers, rectangular maneuvers, which we cannot imitate. So we know for sure it's something different, but we don't have to be afraid of it. Of course. In Space Command, here, in the giant mountain here. They know it, but they don't go to public.
We can prove that in antiquity, our forefathers made gigantic signs in the ground, like today's crop circle. Just it was done by our forefathers some thousands of years ago. And all these designs are laid out in a way that they are so big, you can see them only from the air. I mean, Nazca in Peru is one of the examples, but it's not only Nazca. In the meantime, because of our flying aircraft, because of our helicopters, we found gigantic designs dating from prehistory time in Saudi Arabia, in Australia, in today's Jordania, then even here in the United States, in California, a place called Blight. You see figures in the ground, you can see them only from the air. In Mexico, in the Sonora Desert, there are hundreds of designs which you can see only from the air. And the main mystery is definitely Nazca in Peru. I was so many times in Nazca, I made myself over 5,000 pictures of Nazca. I show you here now pictures of Nazca which were never shown on television. And you really are shocked when you see these designs and look at them carefully. Until today, the scientific community has come up with the following information. All these designs on the ground is an astronomical calendar. It made no sense. Then they say it was a cult for the water gods. Another scientist suggested now it was a cult for the mountain gods. I read always in scientific magazines, now it is a cult for agriculture. My God, this is ridiculous. There was never agriculture. It's too hot for it. If ever, in every time, something was growing there, green, then you would not see the designs anymore. Another suggests that now it's a prehistoric Inca sport place, something like a prehistoric Olympia. Others say now these are copies of Fata Morganas. So the natives somewhere in the air, they have seen some lines, maybe in the clouds. It was a starting place for hot air balloon. We know that hot air balloons could have existed in prehistory time in South America. It's theoretically possible, but we have no writing, no written record about it. But even for hot air balloons, you don't need landing strips. Hot air balloon just start on one place. Another one said, now, these are acre plots, but acre plots means growing of something. There was never something growing there. Another one said, now these are procession streets, you know, for some religion. It's ridiculous. Streets which started abruptly, ended abruptly, etc. Another one suggested, no, this is a prehistoric map. A map for what? For where? Or a cultural atlas. We have had in the scientific community so many explanations, and every scientist thinks this is plausible. That's the next natural explanation. It's all nonsense. Just look at these gigantic lines. This is eye-openers. And on television, you never see these pictures. I have 5,000 of them. In Nazca, there you see some mountains which were artificially cut off. You never see these mountains on television. Somebody cut the top of the mountain off. You can clearly prove it in the pictures. Normal mountains around Nazca, they come to the top from both sides. And you see, it's the top of the mountain. Then you see one mountain where the whole top is cut off. And there is a line on this mountain. And under the line looking like an airstrip, starting abruptly, ending abruptly. Under the line is a zigzag line. No idea, no suggestion what this was. I simply suggest, or in this case I speculate, it has something to do with flying. You see, today we need electromagnetic impulses, for example, to start machines, magnetic. It could be something inside. We have sent a scientific crew to Nazca, and I have asked the scientists a few questions which archaeologists would never ask. Archaeologists ask for datings, for bones, for fireplaces and all these things. I ask, for example, please go to the desert of Nazca with your modern equipment and measure the resistance of electricity. What is the resistance of electricity? If I have a 100 volt, and then I have a measuring device, and I want to see if the electricity is flowing, so I can measure the flow of electricity. And I wanted to know from the scientific world, does the electricity flow in Nazca? Is it the same flowing as in the desert or on these so-called lines? They made their scientific measurements, and as expected, in the desert, in the sand, there is no flowing electricity, because sand is an isolator, like ceramic is an isolator. But then they made the same experience on the lines, with that cut off mountain, where the zigzag lines around them. And the speed of the electrical resistance was 8,000 times higher than just a few meters in the desert. So there is something. I asked the scientists, can you measure magnetic fields in Nazca? Is there something wrong? Of course, there are changements in the magnetic field, and especially on the lines. On that mountain, they found the magnetic field in the ground under the line, which is so high that they could not measure it anymore. So there is something behind it, but nobody knows what it is, and nobody is allowed to go there or make diggings. So we know that something is wrong in Nazca, because we can measure the flow of electricity, the difference in the sand, and the difference in the so-called lines. We can definitely measure the changing of the magnetic field. On the zigzag line, there is something deep down there. But in practice, One would say, okay, so make a hole. What's so difficult there? It's not possible. Nazca is completely protected. You don't receive the permission to simply scratch a little stone away. If you do something, you are immediately arrested. You get in jail in Peru, and you have to pay about $10,000 to get out again. So we know by measurement something is wrong in Nazca, but in practice, we have no possibility to check it. I know from my knowledge of ancient texts, of ancient mythologies, that some thousands of years ago, a gigantic mother spaceship was surrounding around the Earth. Now this mother spaceship, after a long trip, they need something to refuel. I mean, is it organic material? Is it uranium? Is it whatever? So they measure the planet. Where could we find something? Maybe they are looking for gold. And from an orbit, they can measure where we find gold or whatever. Now they simply send an automatic space probe down. An automatic space probe would not need a landing strip. It simply came down like one of our satellites. And before it came to a standstill, it might be that this automatic space probe is blowing away some sand and stones and etc. Before it comes to a standstill. One of the natives was watching this. Something was coming from the guards, from the sky. And this space probe makes some measurements. Hello, what is the magnetic field here? Do we find gold, uranium, or whatever? And disappears again. Another native goes to his tribe and say, hey, something was descending from the guard. I saw it here on the plain of Nazca. And you see a small line simply made, created by the blown away stone and sand. And other natives may think, obviously the gods want that we make some lines for them. And it becomes a religion, a cult. And the natives now make lines in all kinds of directions. Small lines, large lines, thin lines, long lines. The longest of the small lines in Nazca is 23 kilometers long, over cross mountain hill, straight away, 23 kilometers. The longest of the airstrip looking lines is 3.8 kilometers long. Enough to land the jumbo jet. Now, that was my suggestion. The lines were made by the natives because it has become a religious cult. But that's not all. The extraterrestrials, in fact, they found something there, something which they used. We have no idea what it used. And they took it off from Nazca. It was the extraterrestrials, not the natives, who cut the mountain. Because something which they needed was in there. By cutting off the mountain, you have debris. There is nothing in Nazca. Where is all this debris which they took off from the cutting mountain? And maybe they had an automatic landing machine, and the landing machine was working on a magnetic field. And for the magnetic field, they need that zigzag line under the line. Because you, with the zigzag line, you compose an electromagnetical field. So it comes to a standstill, and you pull it the other way around, and you start it again. The local people made with the figures. You see, you have in the ground, you have figures of fishes, spiders, monkeys, birds, and this kind of thing. And these figures were made by the local. You know, Nazca is very, very hot. The surface of the desert of Nazca is composited of little brown stones and sand. Now you have only to use your shoes and to scratch away these little brown stones, and you see itself a higher, bright, shining level appears. And with this you can, in fact, make these figures. There is no mystery in making the figures. You can also make some lines. This is also possible by scratching away with your shoes the surface of it. But the large lines, starting abruptly, ending abruptly, the large big lines on mountains which are cut off are not made by scratching away with your shoes. Here technology was used. So you have to differentiate. There was high technology, in my eyes, from extraterrestrials, which has to do with the cut-off mountains and zigzag lines and these things. And there is imitations of the natives. Even after the extraterrestrials left, when they have received what they wanted, the natives continue to make lines in honors of the god. So you have both there. high technology from extraterrestrials and simply primitive lines made by the natives.
It has been 51 years since the book Chariots of the Gods was written by Eric von Daniken. Today, as then, he continues to research and pass on his vast knowledge gained over the many years. You can watch more of Eric's series, Beyond the Legend, exclusively on Gaia. Click the links in the description to get our limited partnership 1 month trial offer price of only 99 cents. Thanks for watching, and we hope you enjoyed this video. To see more, please check out our channel page linked below. We will leave you now with a short video clip of Eric von Daniken as he explains how he became the man he is today and what it was that gave spark to his amazing lifetime journey on truth and knowledge all over the world.
I was educated in Switzerland as a strict Catholic. And of course, as a young man, I was a deep believer in God. By the way, I still am a deep believer in God. But as a young man, God had to have some qualities for me. For example, God makes no mistake. God is omnipotent. He's all over. He doesn't need a vehicle in which to move from point A to point B. Of course, God makes no mistake. That I had in my head as a 15, 16-year-old boy. Now I was educated in a strict Catholic school led by Jesuits. And there we had to learn Latin and Greek. And always we have to translate parts of the Bible from one language to the other. And I realized slowly that the God of the Bible does not have these qualities I expected. For example, the God in the Bible, he is using a vehicle in which to move around, described by the prophet Ezekiel, for example. And the God in the Bible, he makes mistakes. He creates human and he says, and it was good. But later he finds it was not good and he decided to destroy them all. He makes experiences. He sends Adam and Eve into paradise. And he knows in advance that they will make a sin. And they promptly make what he expected, what he knows. And now he's very disappointed. So I simply had doubts in my own Catholic religion, in my education. I wanted to know if other communities in antiquity have similar stories as we have in my religion. And that was the beginning of Chariots of the Gods. I started to read Hindu mythologies. And even in the college, I was educated in the college, some of the professors who knows that I had doubts in religion said, Eric, go to the university library and ask for a book of Enoch. And as a 17-year-old, I read Enoch. And I realized that here someone is telling us a story in the first person and he's talking about guardians of the sky, fallen angels, sex with humans. That was really absolutely crazy for my young brain. So my doubts continued. And I decided I want, in the beginning, only as a hobby, follow this path. I was growing up in hotels. My family were hotel managers. So I was grown up running through reception and bars and kitchen and so. And it was absolutely normal that after my high school, I took the way of hotel business. So I was in a hotel special school. I was a waiter. I was a receptionist. I was a barkeeper. And whenever today I sit in a restaurant and I realize that the waiters or the barkeepers are doing something wrong, I said to myself, come on, Eric, you could do better. You could stand behind the bar or behind the reception desk. So when I finally wrote Chariots of the Gods, I was managing director of a 5-star hotel in Davos, which is a place in the Swiss mountain. I was fascinated by the idea that in the Bible, in the religions, we are the victims of misunderstanding. I was fascinated then. At that time, in Germany, there was a magazine called Neues Europa, New Europe. And as a young man, as a waiter already, I was writing for this magazine. Even in high school, I was good in writing. I always had the best notes in writing. So I wrote for this magazine about mysterious things in the Bible and so on. In 1964, that was 4 years before Chariots of the Gods was on the market, I published an article, was a full double page, in a big Canadian newspaper. It was a German newspaper called Der Nordwesten, the Northwest, appeared in Winnipeg. And the title was Were the Gods of the Bible Astronauts? By Eric von Däniken. So I was writing about that subject long before I made Chariots of the Gods. I was working in hotels, and the hotels had season. You know, summer season, winter season. Between the seasons, I was always traveling. I learned in all these books about archaeological mysteries, so I wanted to go there. And always before I went to an archaeological place, I knew the literature in advance, and I knew the scientific literature. I knew what the archaeologists said about such and such place. So I read the book before I traveled. Even as a 19-year-old, I was for the first time in Egypt. The high school I was a school for rich kids. And one of the rich kids in my classroom was an Egyptian boy. And he invited me to Egypt. So as a 19-year-old, I was the first time sitting on a camel and standing before the pyramids. As a 19-year-old, I was the first time in subterranean caves in Saqqara. So I was writing about the subject even as a hotel manager. And of course, by the years I knew, I learned a lot. And in the evening, I was always discussing with some guests. Finally, one of the guests said, "You should write a book, Eric." I said, "A book? Okay, why not?" So I wrote a book, Chariots of the Gods, in my free time, in the afternoon or in the evening. And the original book had 235 pages. Then I sent this manuscript to 20 different publishers in Germany. And 20 publishers sent it back. Each and every one with, "Well, this is not for our society. This is not for our edition. And this is not professional enough, etc." It all went turned back. One of the hotel guests I had was the editor-in-chief of a big German magazine. The magazine's name is Die Zeit, The Time. And I said to him, "I have a manuscript now, but nobody wants to publish it." And he said, "Eric, I probably can help you." The next morning, he was phoning to someone which I didn't know, and I hear it. Still, it was today. He said to someone, "Listen, Erwin, I am standing here in a hotel in Davos in Switzerland, and I have a young man here, and this young man has written a complete crazy book. But the man is not crazy. You should listen to him." So that was how Chariots of the Gods was published in February 1968 in Switzerland first. The German title in the beginning had, of course, German words, Erinnerungen an die Zukunft, means memories of the future. Normally, you can memorize only the past. You cannot memorize the future. So Memories of the Future was the original title in the German language, because I had the idea. We were visited by extraterrestrials, and we, the human race, we will do the same thing in the future. We will visit other solar systems, and we will influence others. That's why Memories of the Future. This title has come to the desk of my British publisher in London. It was Souvenir Press, and Mr. Ernest Hecht, he could do nothing with Memories of the Future. He said, "Nobody has Memories of the Future. We can have memory of the past, not of the future." And because I quoted Ezekiel in Chariots of the God, and the word chariots is expressed, Chariots of the God, in Ezekiel, the British publisher decided to name the book Chariots of the Gods. In Switzerland, we have also different magazines, and one of the big magazines still exists today is called Die Weltwoche, the week of the world. And Die Weltwoche, they started to publish the German version of Chariots of the Gods. So it has become a bestseller before the book itself was on the market. Because at that time, I knew already the Mahabharata. I knew the Book of Enoch. And I slowly understood, my God, this is all a misunderstanding. The gods must have been astronauts from another solar system. When I wrote Chariots of the Gods, I had the opinion that I am the first person who write about these things. Later, when Chariots of the Gods were on the market, I received several letters where people just mentioned, dear Mr. von Däniken, but a similar idea we have already in such and such a science fiction story. So science fiction authors were already writing about this speculation, you know, some astronauts are traveling to another world and there they are looked as the gods and so on. Even in some scientific newspapers, and all this I learned later when Chariots of the Gods were on the market, in scientific newspapers there were articles written by scientists with the same question. So I was not the first with that idea and not the first on the market, but I was the first one who took it for serious, not as fiction. I took it as fact, and I brought in Chariots of the God all the sources. I mentioned where did I have these questions and these answers from, so I took it seriously. You know, when Chariots of the Gods was first published, my German publisher, he found an English publisher. And at that time, I was absolutely no professional concerning writing and these things, being an author. So my German publisher suggested, okay, all the foreign right, we make half and half between the publishing house and the author. I said, okay, I agree. I didn't know nothing about it. So the German publisher sold Chariots of the Gods to a British publisher in London. The British publisher sold the right to an American publisher in New York. Hardcover, it was Putnam's and Son. Putnam's and Son sold the paperback rights to another company in the United States. Now, they sold about 8 million paperbacks of Chariots of the Gods. But this publisher made half and half with Putnam. Putnam made half and half with the British publisher. The British publisher made half and half with the German ones, and the Germans with me. So from this 8 million of Chariots of the Gods as paperback, I maybe received a few cents per copy. So I made money, of course. I'm not blaming no one for it. It was my mistake. But it's not that I have ever become a rich man.
Thanks for watching The Fifth Kind. If you like our videos and would like to see more, click the big red button to subscribe. It's free and really does help us out. This video is in association with Gaia.com, creating thought-provoking documentaries and programs. For unlimited access to thousands of educational works and documentaries, please click the links in the description now and receive your 1 month exclusive full access price for only 99 cents. If you would like to support this channel and get involved in new video ideas, please check out our Patreon page, also linked within the description.